Stay tuned for the turning point. Can you imagine being a spy? Can you imagine being a spy? I mean, a real spy for, you know, somebody who goes to work in a secret laboratory or a government facility, maybe some military, secret military place, and then gather all sorts of secrets and send them to clandestinely, of course, some implacable enemy of your country. I don't know what the current equivalent of it would be, but I mean, Snowden doesn't count because Snowden was a sort of a hero revolutionary. He wanted the whole American public. And if the rest of the world found out, too, that's OK. But he wanted the entire American public to know that they were being spied on and everything else that he revealed about what was going on in the inevitable march to a police state. But a spy, somebody who, let's say you have a true enemy, another country that's an enemy or a group of people that are enemies, and you go out of your way to provide them information and to spy. Most people wouldn't be able to do that. You have to have a certain kind of mentality, psychology for it. Either you're a total ideologue and you believe to the exclusion of everything else that what you're doing is right. You would have to be driven to almost to the point of madness of believing that so that you never doubted yourself and you never worried about being caught. You just did what you did. I mean, you took normal precautions, but I mean, most of us lead secret lives. Everybody's got a secret life. I mean, you have to have enough of your own self to yourself to carry on your life. But some people live very secret lives, almost like double lives. But to be a real spy, it would be totally beyond me. It's not not something I'm capable of doing. I think it's not something most people are capable of doing. And there are real spies in the world. I mean, there truly are real spies. There was an obituary in the Times last week. Sorry, my voice is really kind of wretched today, but I'll try to carry on. There was an obituary in the Times last week of a man who died at the age of 92, who was a member of one of the most notorious spy rings in the history of the United States. His name was David Greenglass. And most people who were under the age of, I don't know, 70, don't really know who he is, or maybe under the age of 65. But he was a spy who helped give atomic secrets to the Soviet Union in 1944 and 1945, and for a couple of years thereafter, he was complicit in this kind of thing. And although later on research reveals or documentation reveals that the Soviets were on their way to making this bomb anyhow without his personal help, plans he stole and gave to his brother-in-law, his name was Julius Rosenberg, his brother-in-law, may have actually helped the Soviets in some way to develop an atomic bomb, which set off the terrifying Cold War that affected generations and generations of people and still lingers, you know, the idea of Russia and the bomb. But it was a big, big thing from the 50s all the way through the 80s till the Cold War theoretically evaporated. Now it's actually being dug up again. You know, there is a new sort of Cold War threat. Well, let me try to read some of this obituary and then talk about it. It says, David Greenglass, the brother who doomed Ethel Rosenberg, dies at 92. It was the most notorious spy case of the Cold War. The conviction and execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for passing atomic secrets to the Soviet Union. It wasn't Russia, that was the Soviet Union. And it rested largely on the testimony of Ms. Rosenberg's, Ethel Rosenberg's brother David Greenglass, whose name to many became synonymous with betrayal. He was considered the biggest rat, like a symbol of a rat, for turning, first of all, for spying, and secondly, for turning on his own sister and her husband, who were subsequently executed. For his role in the conspiracy, Mr. Greenglass, an Army sergeant who had stolen nuclear intelligence from Los Alamos, New Mexico, went to prison for almost a decade, then changed his name and lived quietly until a journalist tracked him down decades later. He admitted then, nearly half a century later, that he had lied on the witness stand to save his wife from prosecution, giving testimony that he was never sure about, but nevertheless helped his sister and her husband to the electric chair in 1953. In today's world, where spying has more to do with greed than ideology, people get paid a lot of money for this, the story of David Greenglass and the Rosenbergs is an enduring time capsule from an age of uncertainties, of world war against fascism, Cold War with the Soviets, and shifting alliances that led some Americans to embrace utopian communism and others to denounce such ideas and their exponents as un-American. Think of the McCarthy era. That's what this was all about. Mr. Greenglass, who grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where else, in a household that believed Marxism could save humanity, was an ardent, preachy communist when drafted by the Army in World War II, but no one in the barracks took him very seriously, much less believed him capable of spying. Now, here's a guy, I don't know what this says about the Army during World War II when they're developing a nuclear weapon, but here's a guy who's preaching communism, and nobody took him very seriously. Yet, inevitably, he wound up in Los Alamos. He was not well-educated, but his skills as a machinist and pure luck led to his assignment in 1944 to the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, where America's first atomic bombs were being developed. After being picked to replace a soldier who'd gone AWOL, he lied on his security clearance and was was assigned to a team making precision molds for high explosive lenses used to detonate the nuclear core. When Julius Rosenberg, already a Soviet spy, learned of his brother-in-law's work, he recruited him. Security was often lax at Los Alamos, with safes and file cabinets left unlocked and classified documents lying on desks. Mr. Greenglass had no need for Hollywood spy tricks. He kept his eyes and ears open and in mid-1945 sent Mr. Rosenberg a crude sketch and 12 pages of technical details of the bomb. That September, after the Japanese cities Hiroshima and Nagasaki were destroyed with atomic bombs, ending the war, David and Ruth Greenglass, Ruth being his wife, visited the Rosenberg's apartment in New York. What happened there later became a matter of life and death. For as Mr. Greenglass delivered his latest spy notes, a woman, either his wife or his sister, sat at a Remington typewriter and typed them out. The significance of that act did not become evident for 5 years. By then, the Soviet Union, once America's ally, had become a Cold War foe. Witch hunts for suspected communists were underway, and spy networks were being broken up. Klaus Fuchs, a physicist who worked at Los Alamos, was caught and named Harry Gold as a courier of stolen information. Mr. Gold then named the Greenglasses and the Rosenbergs, who were arrested in 1950. Mr. Greenglass admitted passing secrets to Mr. Rosenberg, but refused at first to implicate his sister. But just before the Rosenberg trial, Mr. Greenglass changed his story, told that Ruth, that is his wife, had informed FBI agents that Ethel, Ms. Rosenberg, had typed his notes. He supported his wife's account and agreed to testify against his sister and her husband. Let's see. Mr. Greenglass's testimony, corroborated by his wife's, clinched the case against Mr. Rosenberg and implicated Mrs. Rosenberg, too, Julius and Ethel. Referring to Ethel Rosenberg in ringing hyperbolic phrases, the chief prosecutor, Irving H. Sapol, you'll notice that the chief prosecutor and, by the way, the judge in this case, too, were Jewish. And I think they were appointed and maybe even volunteered or selected because they wanted to show the entire they wanted to show the entire country that not all Jews were filthy revolutionary communists and traitorous liberals. Anyhow, referring to Ethel Rosenberg in ringing hyperbolic phrases, the chief prosecutor, Irving H. Sapol, declared, just so had she, on countless other occasions, sat at that typewriter and struck the keys blow by blow against her own country in the interests of the Soviets. May have been true. The Rosenbergs were spies. The jury found that the Rosenbergs were guilty of espionage conspiracy, and the presiding judge, Irving R. Kaufman, who was no doubt receiving pressure and direction from the federal government, I don't have any doubt about that, sentenced them to death. Appeals failed, and the Rosenbergs, who rejected all entreaties to name collaborators and insisted they were not guilty to the very end, were executed at Sing Sing on June 19, 1953. Let's see. Skipping ahead. Mrs. Greenglass, David's wife, was not prosecuted. Mr. Greenglass was sentenced to 15 years but was released in 1960 after 9.5 years. He rejoined his wife and for decades lived quietly in the New York area, working as a machinist and inventor. Mr. Greenglass and the former Ruth Prince, who later became his wife, had been neighbors, childhood sweethearts, and members of the Young Communist League, were married in 1942. They had a son and a daughter who survived him. He had several machinist jobs before being drafted in 1943, and the Army put his skills to use. He fixed tank motors, inspected equipment, and worked at an ordnance in California and Mississippi. To pass his security clearance for working at Los Alamos, Mr. Greenglass disguised or omitted communist associations in his background because they were suspected even then. For character and work references, he alerted the writers, the people who use his references, all friends, how to respond, and only glowing reports came back. All evidence indicates, said the reports, that the subject is loyal, honest, and discreet. Army intelligence. Everywhere, even at Los Alamos, he preached communism. Even when he was at Los Alamos, and by the way, a lot of the scientists and the engineers who worked at Los Alamos were definitely 90% of them, including Oppenheimer, who was in charge of it, were liberals, if not actually members once upon a time of the Communist Party or sympathetic to the Communist Party. And there was a reason for that. A lot of them were Jews, too. Even at Los Alamos, he preached communism, I guess not being too bright, trying to persuade fellow GIs and coworkers that they would someday prosper in a utopian society free of squalor and injustice. Letters to his wife, some signed "Your Comrade," also sprinkled dialectics among the endearments. "We who understand," he wrote, "can bring understanding to others because we are in love and have our Marxist outlook." Well, David Greenglass, a spy. And this, all of this has a history. A lot of these people came from Julius Rosenberg and Ethel Rosenberg. A lot of these people came from New York City. And they were, a lot of them were on the Lower East Side. They were Russian Jews originally. Either they came over originally as Russian Jews. A lot of them, you know, were from Eastern Europe. A lot of the German Jews that came over earlier to this country as immigrants took a different path and became merchants, businessmen. Some of them became very rich and outright capitalists. But a lot of the Jews who came over from Russia were revolutionaries. These people came over to the Lower East Side, and they were the victims of the worst. I mean, there was always anti-Semitism everywhere in Europe, but they were the victims of the worst sort of anti-Semitism under the Tsar and in Russia, which persists to this very minute up in Russia and Ukraine and everywhere around there. The Jews in the Soviet Union, a lot of the communists who eventually overthrew, the Bolsheviks who overthrew the Tsar and the imperial monarchy in Russia in 1917, a lot of them were Jews. And it's a good reason for it, because the Jews were brutally treated there. The anti-Semitism resulted in Jews not being able to hold any kind of job that was worth anything. You know, they couldn't be professionals. They were kept in squalor occasionally. They were just murdered, raped. Everything was stolen from them. There was constant, virulent anti-Semitism, worse than any other place in Europe, even in couldn't be worse than Nazi Germany, but it was in Russia. It was as bad as it gets. A lot of the Jews who were of an intellectual turn took immediately to Marxism and communism. And when they emigrated to the United States, they settled in places like New York and a few other cities, but especially New York and certain areas of New York. They were as poor as it gets, the poorest of the poor. And they lived, a lot of them, on the Lower East Side and grew up on the Lower East Side. And so their children were born there, too. And I know about this because my my grandparents wound up on the Lower East Side when they immigrated. And, you know, a lot of them became professionals ultimately, and against great odds, a lot of professional schools, medical schools and engineering schools did not admit Jews, or made it very hard for Jews to be admitted. But they bought into the whole idea of America. And in fact, the Jews migrated to America. They called it in Russia and poorest places in Europe, the Jews in Yiddish and in various languages like Polish and Russia and Russian referred to America as the Golden Land. The Golden Land. And they dreamed of America, those that didn't dream of Israel. And these were the same group of people. They dreamed that they could come to a place where they wouldn't be routinely and arbitrarily murdered, where they wouldn't be spit on or kicked, where they wouldn't be insulted every moment of their lives and kept in complete dire poverty, where there was nowhere ever for them to go, where when they were drafted into the army, they were drafted for 16 years, and a lot of them just died in the army. And, but a lot, like I say, a lot of them also came here, the Jews from Russia. And this is not right after 1917 with the revolution, because a lot of the Jews involved in the revolution stayed right there because they wanted to make, they believed in the utopian idea of Marxism, of communism. And they wanted to make Russia, which was the worst and the most backward of the massive imperial monarchies of pre-World War I Europe, they wanted to make that place, once they overthrew it, into the paradise where everybody into a paradise where everybody was equal, where men and women were equal, where all cultures, where all religions, where all everybody were races, where everybody was equal. And of course, you see how that turned out, because it just utopian ideas like that just don't work out. They're great to have. They're in fact, they're necessary for everybody to have an ideal. But to think that you could put it into practice is childish and fantastical. But that doesn't mean that you don't retain the notion of the ideal or strive to the ideal. I mean, look at American democracy. There are ideals in the Declaration of Independence which have never been achieved and weren't even honest to begin with when they were written down in a place where there were slaves, where some of the people who wrote about the most freeing notions of equality and liberty and justice, they themselves had slaves, Thomas Jefferson for one. So the people, but a lot of the Jews who were given to utopian ideals and idealism themselves in Eastern Europe, especially in Russia, dreamed of this. And a lot of the Jews were intellectuals, too. But these people came to the United States, and they came from all parts of Russia. And they came not, you know, like I say, right after 1917. I think immigration had slowed down from Russia by then. And besides, since the Tsar and the monarchy and the imperial monarchy had been overthrown, the Jews stayed there. The Jews who were part of the Bolshevik Revolution stayed there, Trotsky and countless others, because they believed that they could actually change this vast backward monarchy into a paradise for human beings if they followed the rules of absolute equality, Marxism, and sharing everything where there was no private ownership. They really believed in it. And a lot of people still believe in it. But it is a utilitarian, a utopian idea, which doesn't necessarily correspond to reality, but they believed it. But it was before that. It was from the 1890s through, let's say, World War I, where a lot of Jews, including my grandparents, came over from this poorest of the poor areas, a part of Poland, part of Russia, which kept switching back and forth, the Russian Empire. And like I say, but a lot of the Jews that came over here from other places, and some of the Jews that came over here from Russia then, took the other route. They saw that America was the haven of free market capitalism, that you could become anything, do anything, as long as you made enough money. And you see where that has led to right now. America is a place worse than it's ever been since all the way back in that time. Since back 100 years or more, America is a place now which in which capitalism has run wild, where it's an insane monster that eats everything. And the idea of equality has been thrown totally overboard. Declaration of Independence might as well be used for toilet paper now, as for even the ideals or the reality of it. But people came over here, and a lot of them became landlords. Now, the Jews who lived in these places in Russia and the Pale, it was called, and beyond the Pale, these people were as poor as it gets. They weren't allowed to own land. They could not own land, among the many other things the Jews weren't allowed to do because they were inferior. They were creatures of the devil, blah, 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 the usual anti-Semitic bullshit. But the Jews were not allowed to own land. When they came to America, a lot of people decided that, you know, here's a place where I could make something of myself. And they became landlords. They bought property, and they didn't treat other people very well. They became owners of factories and garment factories and treated workers as bad or worse than anybody treated workers anywhere, you know, like slave labor. And it resulted in the formation of unions. And so it was fascinating that there were Jews on both sides here, that the landlords and the owners and the people who ran businesses and just seemed to be totally greedy out of control, where a lot of them were Jews who never had a chance to own anything or make anything of themselves or make any money. And the people on the other side who were revolutionaries and tried to form unions and were beaten up and killed trying to form unions were Jews. And this clash took place mostly in New York City and especially on the Lower East Side between two sides of the two groups of people who came from the same brutal, battered group of Jews who came from the Soviet Union. and given to the Jews were given to extremism. This I can't explain this whole thing in one little talk here, but the Jews were and still are given to extremism. They were not Buddhists. They were not people of an easygoing nature because of the way they had been treated for 1,500 years, maybe because of the nature of the teaching of their religion and the harshness and the strictness of the religious rules and laws and the God, the awesome God that they have to follow. Jews went to tend to go to extremes about things. Tended to go to extremes about things, and maybe they still do in some ways. And so they, what happened is they wound up taking sides. And a lot of, like I say, a lot of the ardent union people who paid for, you know, for forming this union with their lives and were beaten up and arrested by the cops, and the landlords were Jewish and sicked the cops on them. So it was a question of taking sides. It was always like, which side are you on? That was the question that was asked.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Son, he'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sing it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh, workers, can you stand? Or will you be a man?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Come in here to dwell.
Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Now, I grew up in the early 50s. I was born in 1945. In fact, I was born between the time when Germany surrendered in World War II and the time when the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was born right smack in the middle of that time. So I actually was born into a world where there were no actual functioning atomic bombs being dropped on anybody. They were developing atomic bombs. I forget when the first atomic bomb was tested out in the desert in Los Alamos, near Los Alamos, New Mexico. It could have been before I was born, but there I was, born at a time when these weapons were unknown in the world, when the terror that still affects all of us, you know, the idea of a dirty bomb or where these missiles are or nuclear weapons in the hands of fill in the blank, right? The Israelis. The Americans, the Russians, the Pakistanis, the Indians, the Chinese, the North Koreans. I mean, really. So, but this didn't exist back then. Back then, the weapons were, you know, what's called just standard military weapons. I mean, they were massive and horrible. I mean, giant bombers and jet planes and artillery and all kinds of, you know, awful machinery of death that caused the death of so many millions of people in World War II. But still, the bomb itself, which has terrified the world since it first went off in Hiroshima, and since it started, the ownership of it and the threat of using it spread all over the world. That didn't exist when I was born. So I grew up in this period. But by the time I was 5 years old, and I didn't know anything about this, naturally, but by the time I was 5 years old, the McCarthyism and the witch hunt for communists, because the Soviets were our evil enemy, and I think the Soviets exploded their atomic bomb in 1949. I think that's when they exploded their atomic bomb. And that's when the Cold War was really on. And, I mean, it started before that with the Russians making it very clear that they wanted to have an empire that included as much of Europe and everything around, every other country around them as possible. The Soviet Union, right? But it was no union whatsoever. It was the same old thing. Stalin was a czar. He was just a czar. And anybody who runs Russia, including the former lieutenant colonel in the KGB, the great mafia thug, Putin, these people are no different than the czars who used to run Russia. They make a pretense of some freedom, but there's no freedom in current Russia, and there never really has been. The KGB was always there, and whatever it's called these days, it's still there. If you are, there's no freedom of speech, for instance, in the Soviet Union. If you were to write something in the press or stand up and say something in public which was critical of Putin or the people that were his friends or are his friends, you could, and this happens right up until this day, people are journalists and people who say what they really feel are often arrested, kidnapped, tortured, and killed in Russia. So nothing is very different. And Stalin, one of the great monsters, equal to, almost equal or maybe surpassing when it comes to pure numbers, Hitler, when it comes to being an insane murderer, mass murderer. Stalin was a brute. He was a lunatic. And he was also in the great tradition of Russians, which continues up until this very minute, and a violent anti-Semite. So Jews came from this kind of place. And they developed, and not just in Russia, though, but when it comes to which side are you on, the Jews generally had to become, had to be on their own side. This is what has to happen. When you are treated with intolerance, with brutality and suspicion and hatred almost everywhere, for no good reason, or once in a while here and there, maybe a minor reason, but it didn't even include the whole group of people as Jews. Just some Jews were gangsters in Germany. Some Jews were money lenders because there was nothing else they were allowed to do. And of course, they were allowed to do that because that was considered a filthy, awful thing to do in most cultures. And since the Jews weren't allowed to own land or have professions or do anything else, they took that up as a way of making money. So they became greedy. Think of Shylock, you know. They became symbols of greed. And still in all, that wasn't the main group of Jews. The Jews generally had to keep to themselves. There were ghettos everywhere. Ghetto is an Italian word. I think it began in Venice. Anyhow, ghetto is an Italian word, and it was originally used to describe a neighborhood that where there were people had to stay in that neighborhood. There were curfews. In some cases, there were walls in different cities where the Jews had to live. And all of this goes way, way back. It's a whole long story, which I'm sure a lot of you know about. But the Jews weren't, you know, they chose sides when they got to America because it was safer to do that. In other words, you could be a capitalist And of course, it was safe to do that because who was going to threaten a capitalist, right? Occasionally, some revolutionaries would think of, or anarchists who were Jews would think about throwing bombs or attacking the rich, but that wasn't really taken that seriously. What they really wanted was equal rights. As it said in the American Constitution, as it guaranteed people, unless you were black, and as they dreamed about in these old imperial anti-Semitic monarchies and societies over in Europe that came here for that dream. And when they came here and treated like slaves and treated also by the Irish cops and by the Irish politicians and by the general American public with the same disdain, outright hatred, and sometimes violence, they were extremely disappointed. A lot of them were in despair to see this, but they still were able to work their way up. There was enough freedom, clearly, in America where Jews could become, and you see it all the time, famous scientists, you know, heads of universities, doctors, lawyers, owners of great companies, that kind of thing, heads of unions, politicians, people who hold high offices. So this you see all the time. So they, you know, there was enough of it here for it to be true. And the Jews also had a tradition of now, when you're an outsider all the time, when you're an eternal outsider and you're treated that way, you develop an outsider's point of view, which is that everybody is looking at you funny, that everybody's out to get you. And it's true most of the cases. For a Jew to be paranoid and to say that other people were looking at them funny or treating them funny or saying something, you know, vile or nasty about them, they were right 99% of the time. So they develop an outsider's point of view. And an outsider's point of view can lead to rebellion, can lead to secrecy, can lead to anger, could lead to betrayal, right? Why be loyal to a society or to a culture that turns on you at every moment, that doesn't give you a breath of air, that doesn't let you succeed or lets you get somewhere, only you have to work 10 times harder? So they developed a certain attitude. And also the Jews had a tradition of debate and argument and in their scholarship and even in their religion. When they talked about their religion, they debated and argued. I mean, you know, Abraham in the Bible negotiated with God when God was going to punish somebody for something, which God did frequently. You know, Abraham argued with him. I mean, there's no place in the Christian Bible, you know, in the New Testament, where there's an argument with God as to what he would do. You know, at God, you know, you don't question things like that. The Catholic Church is based on unquestioning obedience, but the Jews in their religion, in their religious practices and scholarship, are constantly debating and arguing with each other about the points of the Bible, what's true, what's not true. So they have this tradition of scholarship and argument and debate. So all of this loaned itself, and also the utopian ideal. Groups of people like the Jews, and I suppose like black people in the United States, people who are treated routinely for hundreds and hundreds of years as outsiders or inferior or as agents of the devil or whatever, developed a group of a fringe group of people or a way of thinking often, which is utopian. And that's one of the problems with the Jews who worked for the Soviet Union. Most of them were not paid to do this. They disdained that. When they were working for the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, the Comintern, which was the international organization, sometimes under the counter, right, sub rosa, to try to promote communism all over the world and take over every government and every land for communism. Now, a lot of the Jews believed that this was going to be so that paradise would spread. Now, a lot of these Jews had never been to the Soviet Union. They didn't see that Stalin was a monster and a barbaric killer. They didn't see that it was nothing but that he was nothing but another czar, and as bad or worse than any czar that ever lived. They didn't see that. They had not, a lot of them had never gone to the Soviet Union. They just received reports, and they daydreamed about what a wonderful place it must be. And of course, the anti-Semitism was virulent there. Under Stalin, he killed hundreds of thousands of Jews and kept them in minor positions. and sent them off to labor camps. So there was this was no paradise for Jews. But the Jews who became spies in the United States did not know this. And people like Julius Rosenberg and his wife Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed, they were and this guy David Greenglass, they weren't stupid. Well, some of them, Greenglass apparently was a little dim, but a lot of the Rosenbergs and a lot of this, the Jewish spies who were members of the Communist Party and wanted to spread this beautiful utopian ideal of total equality, where men and women were equal. There was no discrimination against men, women in jobs. The women could be scientists, and they could be the head of tractor factories, and they could be the head of this and the head of that. You know, where races and religions, where the Jews would not be discriminated against, where a Jew could rise as high as a Jew could. And it happened in the early days of Bolshevism. And it happened sometimes in the Soviet Union. You would see this happen, that women were allowed to be, by the men allowed, to be educated and promoted to areas where they wouldn't even have been at a similar time in a capitalist country. So this is what you saw. So with this, with when you see this from the outside and you were and you're a Jew in the United States, you had this utopian ideal and everybody thought, well, and I guess what the Rosenbergs thought was if the Russians get the bomb, then they will be equal. They won't be threatened by the United States to be, you know, everybody was worried the United States was going to wipe out the Soviet Union. And that was, you know, Stalin's paranoia. And because what he really wanted to do was control the entire world like Hitler did. But they were afraid of the United States, and they had reason to be afraid of the United States, because the United States, being the great capitalist nation that it was, detested the idea of complete equality and communism. And then look what we have here. We have the income inequality, which is maybe as bad or worse than it's ever been in this country. We have people, everything is going backwards. We have all these voter ID laws. We have all these pro-abortion laws that are being passed, anti-female. Everything is being turned backwards, and there are reasons for that. But, you know, when the United States even imagined or saw that the Soviet Union was intending to do this kind of thing or wanted to have a classless society, or so they believed from the outside, they were implacable enemies of the Soviets. They were before World War II. When the Bolsheviks first took over, when the communists, when Lenin and Trotsky and those and that crew took over in 1917, the Americans and the British and one or two other countries sent troops over there to destroy that revolution. They sniffed it from that far away. They said, this is something they will do away with private property and with capitalism, and we can't have that. And they tried to actually destroy that revolution, and it was a war, like a civil war, but aided and abetted by America and other places, other capitalist countries. Went on for 3 years before these people were defeated and the communists took over completely. And, of course, when the communists took over, they immediately instituted, they had secret police. The czar had his own secret police. I forget what it was called. But immediately they replaced the secret police, the Soviets, with their own secret police. And anybody who wrote anything that was anti-government, there was no free speech in the Soviet Union from the very beginning. Why the Jews in the United States believed that the Soviet Union was some kind of paradise is a mystery to me. They were told this by other people. They were convinced of it. Maybe they wanted to have this paradise because they had been suppressed for so long, and they wanted to. And a lot of them came from Russia. You know, a lot of them literally were immigrants from Russia or the children of immigrants from Russia. They were brought up with this ideal, like Greenglass was on the Lower East Side. They were brought up with this ideal, as I was brought up, third-generation American. As I was brought up with a Roosevelt kind of liberalism, which a lot of people considered to be out-and-out communism. You know, the idea of supporting unions, of supporting workers, of the government being looked at as actually the property of the people of the United States, which it should be. We pay for it. God knows that the capitalists do everything they can, the rich people do everything they can to get out of paying for it and pay very little of their share of it. But the most of us, the rest of us, middle class people, if there is a middle class anymore, pay for it. We're the ones who pay for it. So, you know, the Jews saw the Soviet Union in this utopian way for all the various reasons I'm mentioning. They saw it as a kind of utopia, and they spied for it. They spied for it. And there was a tremendous number of Jews involved in the Communist Party in the United States, and Jews who turned out later to be spies, actual spies for the Soviet Union, and gave them all kinds of secrets. Now, I was growing up during this time. I didn't know about any of this. But well, I was 8 years old when the Rosenbergs were executed. And there was no talk about that and if there in my house. And if there was, they weren't talking about it in front of me. But on the other hand, I didn't live in a regular house. But what happened in the real world was not discussed in my house. My house was its own sort of private little maniac asylum where the news didn't filter in. If I wanted it, I had to go outside and find out about it. But I lived in a lower middle class neighborhood, and a lot of the people there were Jews who had emigrated from the inner city. And by the time they got out there and been through the Depression and World War II, there were very few communist type of Jews or socialist type of Jews. They had all become Roosevelt liberals, which was kind of the outcome of going through the war and going through the Depression. And Roosevelt came as close as any, and his administration and the people who worked for him and his policies came as close as any government has ever come in this country to being a government which truly believed that it belonged to the people, that shared out these benefits, that invented Social Security and all these other programs. And things that came later, like Medicare and all these other things, came from Democrats who had grown up during Roosevelt's time, who were brought up on Roosevelt's government. The idea of providing, when the whole country was out of work, of the government providing jobs, right, of going into debt to borrow money to pay workers so that they could support their families and build a life, and so later on they'd be able to pay taxes. That was the whole idea. You know, Roosevelt was no communist, but he had a lot of people advising him who were former socialists and probably a couple of communists, too. But the Jews were pulled towards the Communist Party. And my father, for instance, went to City College in New York City, which was a notorious hotbed of communists, people who belonged in the Communist Party. And this was in the 30s. Julius Rosenberg was at City College. I think he studied to be a chemist or an engineer. He was at City College, which was famous for its engineering school and physics and chemistry. A lot of them were later, a lot of the people who went to City College were later recruited to work on the atomic bomb project. And they did that because they wanted to defeat Nazi Germany. See, the other thing that attracted the Jews to Russia wasn't necessarily because they was a communist paradise. The Jews weren't stupid. They knew better than that. But Russia was the country all the way up until 1944 that was carrying the tremendous brunt of dealing with Hitler. The Russians kept Hitler at bay. The Russians were the ones who paid the heaviest price fighting Hitler. And since Hitler was so insanely, he's symbolic of the most anti-Semitic, crazy murderer of Jews and the worst treatment of Jews in the history of civilization, or what passes for civilization. The fact that the Russians under Stalin were fighting Hitler was enough for many, many Jews to say, well, then there are people. Then we're going to do anything we can to help the Russians. And that's why a lot of the Jews belonged to the Communist Party. That's why a lot of Jews became spies during the 30s and especially during the 40s to steal secrets to give to the Russians to make them powerful because he was fighting Hitler. The United States didn't land in Europe until June of 1944, but the Russians were fighting Hitler for years before that and losing millions and millions and millions of people. And there were Jews in the there were Jewish officers, there were, Jewish commissars and the Jewish soldiers fighting against the against Hitler in Russia at the time. And a lot of the feeling that the Jews had was also based on this, that the Russians were the ones who were dealing with Hitler. Well, nobody else was, particularly. You know, the Americans and came and landed in 1944. Their own country wasn't fighting Hitler yet. I mean, we were fighting the war, but we weren't really landing in Europe and actually just creating a second front until June 1944. I mean, the Americans did fight, you know, the Nazis in Italy and in North Africa before that, but not till 1944. The Russians paid the big price for it. And when I was growing up in the 50s, McCarthyism was all over the place. I mean, anti-communism. When you saw it, when they called these people up before the McCarthy committees, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, whatever it was, and in the Senate, I forget the name of the Senate committee, they called these people up. A lot of these people who were members of the Communist Party or screenwriters or members of unions or professors that they called up who had been in the Communist Party, who really were utopians. They were utopians. They weren't spies. 99% of them weren't spies. They just were members of the Communist Party. A lot of these people were Jews. A lot of these people were Jews for the reasons that I have mentioned. And these people's lives were ruined. A lot of them committed suicide. Their lives were ruined. They were fired from university jobs. They weren't allowed to write screenplays or be actors or directors for 10 years or more, you know, 15 years, 20 years even. So this is the kind of thing that and this witch hunt stuff prevailed the whole time when I was a kid. And I didn't know about it. It was like a storm blowing over me. I had no idea whatsoever. But we grew up under the threat of the bomb. We grew up under the threat of the bomb. And we now people hear about this and they think it's hysterical. But there were bomb shelters. People were building bomb shelters. The government encouraged bomb shelters. And sometimes still, if you travel through the city, if you travel through New York City, I don't know if this is true for other cities, you see a sign, which is a distinctive design. I forget exactly what the design is. And it will be on the walls or near the basements of certain very large apartment buildings in New York City, which was meant that it was a designated bomb shelter against an atomic bomb attack. So theoretically, the ignorance is massive, right? People didn't really know, and they never did see or understand way into the late 50s and even the 60s. They didn't really know what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They had no idea what the destruction of that place was like and what an atom, or one single, small, at this point, fission bomb could do to the to a city like Hiroshima or Nagasaki. People, they weren't even shown these pictures for many years after. Part of that is a kind of guilt, I guess. But the United States knew, the United States military and the government knew what kind of destruction could happen. And yet they went ahead and told people, and this affected me too, they told people all over the United States, and this was the great fear that the Soviets had the bomb, and that any minute that these bombs would come raining down on us from missiles, not from planes. The Soviets didn't have that much of a long-range air force, but they had intercontinental ballistic missiles. And they would just, out of the blue, come raining down on us. And we had to protect ourselves by going into basements. We had to go into basements of buildings. And presumably, we could have, you know, there was canned food there. And everybody also, if you could afford it, was encouraged to build their own bomb shelter. That means that people were, a lot of people in the country, they were selling these things. If there was an internet now, you could go to Amazon or www.bombshelters.com, and you could buy yourself, presumably if you're on Amazon Prime, you would get free delivery. You could buy yourself a bomb shelter, and people did. They dug shelters in their backyard. You know, they dug these gigantic holes in their backyards, poured concrete, and stuffed them with canned goods and with water in case there was an atomic attack. And presumably they would come out at some time later, an undesignated time, and everything would be okay. You know, the Dodgers would still be playing the Giants. There'd be no problems. You just stay down in the bomb shelter for a little while and you'd be cool. And when I was a kid also, we had pretty frequently, we had a sudden air raid drills where when I was in the fifth grade or the sixth grade, I was 10 or 11 years old, Let's say it's 1940, 1954, 1955. This is after the Rosenbergs, still at the height of the Cold War. A siren would go off where the teachers would announce, boys and girls, this is a drill. In case of an atomic bomb, what do you do? And it was called duck and cover. What you would do is you would duck down underneath your desk. So you had hundreds of thousands, millions of school children all over the United States in the 50s, including me, hiding underneath their school desks and then covering your head with your hands and curling up into sort of a fetal position. In case an atomic bomb attack came in Manhattan, we were out in Queens. If we were, theoretically, if we were underneath our desks, then nothing would happen to us. We wouldn't get cut by the flying glass, and presumably maybe the radiation would be repelled, the atomic radiation would be repelled by the 75-year-old scarred wooden school desk that we were underneath. It was called duck and cover. And I remember there was one girl in my class, Shari, her real name, who had tremendous respect for. She was brought up by people who probably had been members of the Communist Party. I'm not really sure. But I can't say that for sure, so I shouldn't really say it. But they were union members, and maybe they had, you know, they had sympathies with the communists, as many, many, many Jews, especially intellectual Jews and union members, did. She was brought up to... she was brought up with this tradition. And this tradition, by the way, extended itself into all other directions. The Jews had a tremendous liberal tradition. Being outsiders and being treated like dirt in most places at most times, they were the ones who were the freedom riders on the buses. They were the ones who were the anti-war, you know, in massive numbers that were, much larger than the proportion of other groups of people. They were the ones who turned out to demonstrate against war, against the Vietnam War, against nuclear weapons, against maltreatment by landlords of tenants. The Jews were famous for this in New York City. So this spreads in other ways. This protesting of treating people unfairly or unjustly. And my friend, who, by the way, endeared herself to me forever, by being the only child in my entire elementary school to refuse to get under the desk, saying that it was absurd. She was also she was the smartest kid in the school. She said, it's ridiculous for me to get under this desk and help perpetuate this hysteria. She didn't talk that way when she was 10 years old. But she said, I'm not going to buy into this crap. I'm not getting under the desk. It's useless anyhow. If a bomb goes off here, what good is it going to do me to be under here? I mean, it's not going to make any difference, and I won't get under the desk, and I'm not going to participate in this endless Cold War. Her parents were telling her at her age, the rest of us didn't know, about the McCarthyism and the witch hunt and the persecution of people who had been members of the Communist Party, who were 99% of the time just innocent people who believed in freedom and equality. Her brother was one of the first freedom riders that went down south. A lot of the people who went down south, white bus riders from up north, to help blacks get the vote and risk their lives and lost their lives in some cases, were Jews. So it spreads itself in every different direction. And I think a lot of the liberal tradition that you see with Jews, although that's pretty much on the wane now, I'd say. It's pretty much on the wane, despite the prevailing inevitable attitude about the Jews as money grubbing or greedy. In fact, yeah, I suppose a lot of them are, but so is a lot of other groups of people. But look at the Russians. Look at the Americans. Are the Walmarts, are the Waltons Jews? Is Putin a Jew? Are the Saudi sheiks Jews? Are the Chinese leaders, the capitalist pigs in China, are they Jews? No, they're not. But I know for sure, having been one of them, that a lot of protest people, a lot of people who are on what I would call the decent humanitarian side of issues, are Jews. And it comes from the same tradition, maybe not exactly the same, that caused utopian idealists, people like Greenglass and Julius Rosenberg and all these other people who were really spies and did the wrong thing for their country, who did the wrong thing against their country. These people come from the same material from the same basic DNA, the same basic political and cultural and psychological DNA as the rest of the Jews, as other Jews who have gone in more, a lot of Jews did not spy, but a lot of Jews fought in World War II. A lot of Jews developed the atomic bomb at Los Alamos and in Manhattan, and a lot of the people who were from Berkeley or from New York City, from Columbia. A lot of these people were Jews or City College. So you get liberals and you get socialists and you get communists, but this is from the same group of people. So here's David Greenglass, died at the age of 92 and set me to thinking about all these different things. And they all still believed, no matter what the truth was, since they had never been there, and they still refused to accept the fact that the Soviet Union was a massive, brutal dictatorship that hated Jews and treated everybody as bad as Hitler treated people in his own country. And they still believed that Russia was this noble place, and they were going to work as hard as they could to make it achieve whatever goal it wanted to.